It is another edition of No Filter Sports, April 23rd, a Thursday, 2020. NFL Draft is tonight. Of course, we're recording in the morning, so we don't have any results for you on that. But I tell you, we got still got a good show lined up, and I'm very excited about our guest list over the next week. May I go over that? Today, we have Rick Barry, Hall of Famer, one of 50 all-time greats, as he was voted back in 96. First player to jump leagues, challenge a reserve clause. So many things to say about Rick Barry. Only man, by the way, I'll give you one more, led the NCAA, the NBA, and the ABA in scoring. Only person to ever do that. We're going to talk to him later.
And he's older than me.
He's one day older than Denny. Dave Bing next Thursday. Dave Bing, the great Dave Bing. Let's ask Rick about him today just to get a comparison. He played against him. And Gus Johnson, the Detroiter, the Fox broadcaster, Bob's former intern, is going to join us on Monday to talk about how all this is affecting him and the world of play-by-play and sports, et cetera, et cetera. NFL
and then Thursday.
All right,
and
well,
then
hang on a minute. Let's promo one more guy. In 2 weeks, we got Bill Lee.
That's right.
Yes,
Crazy Bill Lee. We'll have him. It'd be a very interesting half hour, won't it?
It will be, as well as Eli managed to get the mayor, the ex-mayor, on our show.
Yeah, we got Dave Bing next Thursday, Gus Johnson on Monday.
Good.
So, you know, obviously we're not going to be able to talk about the NFL draft that people will see, but, you know, I'm kind of glad that it's back to where it used to be, which is, although it's, I shouldn't say that, because it's still going to be a TV show, even though the players are going to be remote. We'll still have Mel Kiper, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, tell me if you agree, this stark contrast. Now the NFL draft has become guys in garish suits. You know, they loaded downtown like Nashville with thousands of people. It's just like this huge celebration and show just to pick guys. And, you know, in the old days, as I said, Pete Rozelle would be in a ballroom at some hotel in New York. A guy from a team would hand him a piece of paper. He'd write it on a blackboard, and you'd read about it the next day in the paper. This was like what sports was like in the old days. You'd read about your team the next day in the paper. But now it's all immediate, and the show has just gotten ridiculous, I think. So I'm not going to miss the extravaganza that we have. And by the way, tonight was supposed to have been guys like Burrow going in a boat across a moat at the Bellagio and then getting off to go into this big scene. So
yeah, you're totally right. I'm with you 100%. So you know what I do? I do what you and I always do anyway. I record it and then I watch it. I won't start watching the draft Thursday night till maybe an hour and a half into it. And when the San Diego Chargers, with the umpteenth pick of the draft, select John James, offensive guard from Bemidji State, and I fast forward right through that. Next pick, please. Next pick, please. You know, and that's really the way you have to watch the draft now.
And well, you know, go ahead, Denny.
There's one thing that I want to say about the draft. There's a lot of things that could happen over this draft and a lot of crazy stuff. And I still think Kaepernick is going to get a job after this draft somehow. But you know what? We're going to finally find out what the magic number is for Burrow. And we're not going to find out the total number, because he's going to have all kinds of endorsements and probably signed most of them already. But what a mountain of money that kid is going to get.
Wait,
no boat.
He gets a prescribed contract that is to the penny what it's supposed to be. There's no negotiating with him.
Eli, that's not true. I'm not talking about the NFL.
He needs the endorsements.
I'm talking about tens and tens of millions of dollars. And then the other thing is Eli Manning called Burroughs, and they had a long conversation about what he should expect. And because in Manning's first year, he was 3-13, and then he went 13-3 the next year. But the bottom line is Manning told him, be ready for a beating, be ready for blowouts, be ready for a lot of bumps and bruises, because you're going to get them. He says, but then you'll be ready for the second year.
I want to bring up another aspect of the NFL draft here that I found interesting this week. You know, as much as we may dislike Nick Saban and Alabama and the things he does there, we have to watch them because they're always so good. We always see him at a bowl game. And I love this Jerry Jeudy, the wide receiver. Jerry Jeudy, it was revealed this week, scored ready for this? 9 on his Wonderlic intelligence test. You can't blame Alabama for recruiting him, nor for the University of Miami recruiting Frank Gore, the great running back some years back. He had a 6 on his Wonderlic test.
What's the average
score? 9 out of what?
What's the average?
I was just going to say, 30, the average 50, score for anybody coming out is 20. Alex Smith, the Utah quarterback, longtime NFL quarterback, scored a 40, and some guys have beaten that. So these single digits are just ridiculously low. But the point is, where are these kids supposed to go? It's not like basketball or hockey where they have other options. They have to play college football. There's no minor league football. So I don't really blame Alabama for recruiting him. But what do you guys think in terms of how much intelligence matters when it's translated, if it's translated, to a National Football League career?
Well, there's all different definitions of what smart means, intelligent means, wise means, savvy means, savant means. Do you think Dennis Rodman is intelligent? Dennis Rodman, though, is a savant when it comes to basketball. So I think there's different. Was Yogi Berra smart? Nobody has had a genius for playing the game. So this Wunderlich test has got nothing to do with their grades in college, for their ability to write an essay or anything like that. The Wunderlich test is like general awareness of what's going on in the world. I think it's a private or it's a specialized thing for the NFL. It's got nothing to do with academic learning, language ability, any of that, I don't think.
And like every time we talk about this subject, we've always said these kids go to school to play football and basketball and whatever other sport they want to be a professional in. So a 9, a 6, a 2, a 1 really doesn't make any difference. That's not the reason they're there.
No, but
Let me ask Denny this then. During your own baseball career, I know you played with guys you thought were dumber than dirt. Did intelligence ever actually translate to baseball games? Did you, we would have won that game, but that stupid guy hadn't done that?
No, I think baseball is much more of a game of fundamentals than it is. No, I mean, everybody knows you got to hit the cutoff, man, right? Everybody knows that. I mean, and that's as complicated as the game gets. Can I hit the cutoff man and make the game better? But I don't understand any other part of it. You don't have to be a real smart guy to hit the ball. You just got to have some talent. And if you're a pitcher, you got to be able to throw strikes. So, I mean, the game is pretty simple. I mean, that may be the wrong game to look at in a grand scheme of thing, because basketball, hockey, and football, they've got a lot more schemes and planning to do than baseball ever would.
Yeah, you know, and it comes down to mental toughness, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be the smartest guy in the world and understand the game, but if you panic in certain situations. Back to the draft for a minute. We're talking about the extravaganza, the ridiculous showmanship, the garish pink jumpsuits and all that. You know, and I said the old days where they would just write the name on a piece of paper. This is what's happened that really bothers me about sports that I hope it scales back, like boxing. Two guys used to walk from the dressing room to the ring, shadow box. They'd introduce a couple celebrities. They'd go to them. Now, this last heavyweight championship fight, and this is equating to this ridiculous draft, what it's become. Deontay Wilder wears a 45-pound costume for half an hour that ruins his chances to fight. So I wish we'd get back to the simpler way of doing the draft and all this stuff. And just, but I guess it's the TV age, and it'll never be the same. It'll never go back.
Hey, Denny mentioned Rob Gronkowski coming back to the NFL. If he's coming back already, I don't know why he ever quit for 1 year. I don't know when the NFL is going to play. I've said not this year. So he joins Tom Brady in Tampa. Did you see the great welcome Tom got? Working out in the park this past week there. Some kind of rent-a-cop apparently saw him and threw Tom Brady out. The parks are closed.
That's right.
The parks are closed. Doesn't matter. Oh, excuse me. I'm Tom Brady. I don't think you understand this. Doesn't matter. Now, did you see what else Brady's going to do? A Tiger Woods-Phil Mickelson match involving Brady and Peyton Manning is planned for May, according to Turner Sports. The match is called Champions for Charity. It's going to benefit coronavirus relief. The event will air live on TNT, possibly Memorial Day weekend, at an undisclosed location, and of course, without spectators. So I'm going to ask the same question again. Why can't people play golf? And guess what else? Here's the second part of the question. Tennis courts are closed everywhere. That's not social distancing, playing 60 feet apart in some kind of a tennis court? What are they doing this for?
It's inconsistent. Well, it's very, and at the same time, you can go get a massage and a haircut in Georgia. So it's a very inconsistent.
And but let me add to Gronk. Let me talk to Gronk a minute.
Yeah, I'll talk about that for a while. Go ahead.
He's been a great player for a long time before he retired. I'll never forget his retirement gig when he's cried half the time. I mean, That's how bad he felt. He was sick from playing. Every bone in his body hurt. He could never play again. I mean, he was a devastating blocker. And Tampa Bay, by the way, has got a great offensive line. So, I mean, he's going to have lots of assets to help him there. And the thing about Brady and him back together again, and I don't think Gronk will play the entire season. I have no reason to believe that believe it.
I just think
it's so tough. I came back from a 90-day off one time. Well, longer than that because the end of the season had ended and I didn't get back till July. And I got news for you. Just to get the mental approach back is almost impossible. You just don't get it. It's just a tough thing. And I just think coming out of retirement is the toughest thing in the world. And I think he's probably forgot more about aches and pains, and he's going to learn real quick how much it still hurts.
Yeah, you know, he retired exactly a year ago, March 24th, 2019. Yeah. And you're right, last August, he's tearfully saying he doesn't miss football and all the pain it inflicted. This is like a drug addict. Maybe a bad analogy, but it's a drug. The adrenaline, the camaraderie, the teamwork, the reason you want to be on a team, the things you miss, the male world, whatever it is. And so, yeah, now he feels better. And, you know, he's taking a calculated risk. He's going to pay a price. It means that in his later in life, he has had three back surgeries, going to have a fourth back surgery. But I guess there's some lure about the game because you can't replicate that camaraderie and excitement anywhere else. And he just won a WWE title.
Yeah, he sure did.
But you see, that's so phony. he's a broadcaster. Supposedly, he jumps off the platform, he pins some guy, wins a title. I mean, you know, he wants to get back to sports that are at least a little more realistic, okay?
I wanted to add something with Gronk. You know, and there's no doubt he was beat up. He's lost a lot of weight, too, so he's got to start packing on some pounds. However, this whole idea about being tired from football, could that really be translated to he was tired of Bill Belichick's way of football?
No.
You don't think so?
Absolutely not. Listen, you don't even know who your coach is when you're playing. You really don't.
He wanted to get out of there, though.
All day long about having to go to practice and do 50 sit-ups and 1,000 whatever other exercises they're doing and run around the ballpark. But believe me, once you step between the lines, you don't even know who your coach is.
Well, but in fairness to Mark, I agree. The whole excitement about it's the best story. It's the best preseason story. There may not even be a season, but it's the most. In fact, do you have the Dick Vitale thing there? Do you have that, what Vitale said yesterday? Did you see that tweet?
Tell me this is true. I can't believe this. Gronkowski to the Bucks. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Brady to Gronkowski. They're shocking the world, the Tampa Bay Bucks. They are for real, man. Oh, I hope we can play football this year. I can't wait. My season tickets, man. I'm so excited. Are you kidding me? I'm jumping in.
We did something we've never done before on Monday's show. If you were with us, you know, we had two guests, Craig Wolanin and Arnie Kander. So there were a number of stories we couldn't quite get to. Among them, we did not mention the Boston Marathon was supposed to have been run on Monday. So, Eli, did you actually ever go to the New York City Marathon all the years you lived there and worked there?
No.
I did. It's just an amazing sight. So the New York Post reported on Wednesday that Stephen England ran the Boston Marathon anyway. Kinda.
Yeah.
By jogging around the rooftop of his Manhattan apartment building more than 1,000 times. England is a 40-year-old general contractor who's run 90 marathons and ultra marathons. He was committed to honoring his race entry for Boston, so he hoofed it 26.2 miles, all while adhering to the stay-at-home guidelines in New York City. And one of the many great things about these marathons are the changes of scenery through the courses. The New York City Marathon actually goes through all five boroughs. So this would have been mighty boring, huh?
I suppose. Hey, one more thing before we put Gronk away, okay? Here's what I was thinking. Tell me if you buy the analogy. You know the old proverb about the spider and the frog, or the tarantula and the frog, where the spider's got to get across the water. He asks the frog if he can be on his back. The frog says, yeah, but you got to promise you don't bite me and kill me because you're poisonous. He says, I won't. They get 2/3 of the way across, or they're about the end, and the spider bites the frog, and he says, why? I'm going to die now. I'm dying. Why'd you do this? He says, because it's my nature. So Gronk knows he's taking the risks. He knows it's going to make the rest of his life tougher, his knees, his joints, his head trauma, but it's his nature, and he can't stop playing.
And by the way, he called Tom. Tom did not call him, by the way. The story goes anyway in the Boston paper. that he called Tom and says, hey, how would you like to have the best tight end in the world? So I hope he's that guy.
Every time I try to kind of, you know, steer the conversation away from Gronk, you guys steer it back. Are you finished with him now?
I'm sorry.
Bob. You got another marathon story?
All right, now let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, where the U of M announced cuts Monday to all three campuses, the big one, Dearborn and Flint, and the University of Michigan's vaunted medical school, including reductions in hours, pay, and non-essential expenses. In addition, President Mark Schlissel said there'd be hiring and salary freezes. And if the financial situation worsens at the University of Michigan, deeper cuts, layoffs, he suggested the university did not plan to tap into its huge endowments because those are for something else. The pandemic, says Schlissel, has threatened the financial stability and future strength of the University of Michigan, but damage. He didn't even mention the damage awards. They'll be coming in real soon from the growing number of lawsuits.
Oh, I thought you were getting to that. They're going to lower Jim Harbaugh's $9 million salary, as opposed to, you know, cutting their teachers back $3 an hour or $10 an hour.
Did you see, the story in USA Today Thursday, and the Detroit Free Press had it too? It's about a man named Chuck Christian, an ex-football player at Michigan. He was a tight end in the late 70s. Both Eli and I covered those teams. I don't remember him.
I do.
He's an artist living in Boston. He's 60. He now has late stage prostate cancer. He claims in college that he was violated by Anderson in physicals. And that's why over the many years since then, he's not been seeing any physician about his problem. So he's going to sue Michigan over that. Now, curiously, Christian says that everybody knew what this creep was doing. All the jocks did. Curiously, he says, Bo and Canham did not. Curiously, if Anderson were doing this to Michigan athletes, and Eli and I knew every big star there in football and basketball during that era, how come nobody ever stepped forward? And they still haven't stepped forward.
That's the question. Three dozen have sued, though. Three dozen are part of the lawsuit. So they're stepping forward now that it's been... the story has been penetrated, bad pun, I know. But the Chuck Christian story is tragic. He said he was so traumatized and there was pain when he, you know, touched his prostate in there that he didn't go to the doctors and he's supposed to. And here's the other point. Nobody under 40 should ever get a rectal exam for prostate. And that's what such another thing that you're right. How did Anderson get away with it?
Yeah.
It's just awful. Hey, I want to tell you about Luke Nowacki. Worked with
individuals,
families, businesses. He is a Pinnacle Wealth Strategies and a great friend of our show and the others in the Red Shovel Network. Most people don't spend enough time in their investments. And I tell you, this is an interesting time. You talk about what companies you should keep, the companies you should dump, what the future holds, how this is all going to play out. It seems to me that you can make some type of clearer, even estimate of what the market's going to do, understanding what's going to happen with this coronavirus the next couple of years. So go see Luke, 248-663-4748. Tell him what your situation is. He'll answer all your financial questions. The consultation is free. Check it out. Luke Nowacki, 248-663-4748. Advisory services off the Royal Alliance Associates, Inc. are the marketing names, products, services, reference, your independent Royal Alliance Associates. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. And coming up shortly, the great Rick Barry, one of the greatest players of all time and an all-round player, not just a great scorer. And we got some funny pieces to play for you with the underhanded free throw and things like that never changed the game. He really failed at that. Barry wanted to get everybody to do the underhanded free throw. He retired as the all-time percentage leader, but still can't get anybody to do it.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, too, he was voted one of the top 50 greatest players, I think, in 1996 or 1998. What a player he was.
1996 when they did it, yeah.
And so many younger people just don't know because they never saw Rick Barry play. Right. Hey, Eli, I wanted to mention, since we're on Michigan football, the topic of guests, folks, remember, if you were listening to our Mark Spindler show, we had a couple of funny moments, a lot of funny moments with Spindler. And so there was somebody in Spindler's room where he was doing our show from. So at one point we said, well, who's in there with you? Is that Rocco? And his son, I think most of you know, is a great high school All-American offensive tackle being recruited by everybody. Mark said, yeah, it's just Rocco in here with me. Eli yells, tell him to go to Michigan. I yell back, tell him to go to Michigan State. Well, Eli, and all you guys are Michigan fans, I just read an interview with Rocco himself the other day. He says he's narrowed it down to two choices for college.
Let me guess.
Notre Dame and Michigan.
Yeah. Notre Dame. We got him in there. He's going to Notre Dame. Watch, guys. He's going to Notre Dame.
No way. Well,
all of my Catholics are applauding this morning.
Not me.
Bob, knock it off, Mark.
All right, back to Gronk then, right? No, just kidding.
Let's not go back to Gronk. Hey, Eli, I got something for you. Because all you guys are pretty much staying inside now, rarely go up. And when you do, I know that you wear masks and your gloves, whatever else you're doing. So from the website, terrific website, Deadline Detroit this week, they have a big fashion article and they have pictures of all kinds of Detroiters. They are wearing their plague masks, of course, but they've also become fashion accessories. So somebody will always try to make a buck off everything. So we see pictures of women wearing their masks, and their Detroit Tigers masks, their Detroit Pistons masks. And if you like to dress up and go out, if you're still going out, no matter what color outfit you choose to wear, you can pick up a mask now that matches your suit or matches your dress or whatever you're doing. So, be looking for that if you go out of the house pretty soon. Bobby. And the NHL is dicking around, pardon my French, with plan after plan to somehow complete the season. Did you see the latest? According to Elliot Friedman, I see him at least. I think you do too on Hockey Night in Canada roundtables. The plan is to play all the games beginning in July in only 4 centrally located cities and blah, blah, blah. It seems like Pipsqueak Beckman is just throwing stuff up on the wall now to see if anything sticks.
Did you say Bettman or Beckman?
Bettman. Gary Bettman. Beckman is that other guy on the radio in Detroit that we don't like and doesn't like us,
But Bob, you weren't making fun of people wearing masks, were you?
What's that?
You weren't making fun of people wearing masks, were you?
Of course not. I'm just suggesting to Eli why wear a plain white mask when he can wear a Pistons mask or something in public.
I'll tell you something else you'll agree with me on too. Jennifer and J-Lo. They're going to buy the New York Mets like hell they are. If they didn't let Mark Cuban in Major League Baseball, what chance do you think that these two gunkle heads have a chance of getting in Major League Baseball?
You know what the toughest part of the mask is that I hate the most?
The mask. I'm talking about J-Lo.
Well, she's not going to buy any professional team.
There are going to be other effects from this too, boys. I don't know if you saw this, but during the month of March just concluded, Americans bought $275 million worth of frozen pizza. Adweek reports, the well-respected publication, this is an increase of 92% from this time the previous year. Some frozen pizza brands report increased sales of as much as 190% over a year ago. So what they're doing is now they're starting to hoard frozen pizza besides toilet paper and everything. I still can't figure out this toilet paper thing, but my goodness, I'm down to one frozen pizza in my freezer right now. What the hell am I supposed to do?
Invest in DiGiorno. Put all your money in DiGiorno.
Or go out and buy some pizza franchises.
You know, one reason I don't mind being able to talk about the draft today, it's a big story. People are going to know what we have to say about it. They can't. Do you realize that if you wanted to bet on the first pick and you wanted to choose Joe Burrow, the first pick, if you bet, you'd have to bet $100,000 to win 100. He is a minus $100,000 favorite. That's how sure he is. He's the first pick. And I don't know what's going to happen because it hasn't happened yet. But I will guarantee you, bet the farm. We all know who the first 3 or 4 picks are. We know it's going to be Burrow. We know it's going to be Chase Young. We know it's going to be Jeff Okuda to the Giants. Lions. Yeah. The only differing is in the 5th pick, where some think that the Dolphins will take Tua and some think they'll take an offensive lineman. I think it's going to be a very boring draft because they haven't been able to interview these players, bring them in for pro days, discuss the Wunderlich test. It's really on a lot less information. So I think it's going to be a much more predictable draft than it used to be.
I hope Tua does very well because he's been through hell getting himself repaired and recovering all the time. A couple of broken ankles, a bad back for a while, a bad shoulder. I mean, this kid has really put up with an awful lot of injury to still be hanging around. And they say has been performing tremendously. So
he hasn't been able to show it to teams, unfortunately.
Right.
Did you see what Deion Sanders said? He said that he would take Tua over Burrow because he's seen more tape of Tua. and he knows that he can overcome adversity. He makes great decisions. He handles himself well on the microphone. So we'll see. That would be a shame if he played last
year. I thought the story you just mentioned was very interesting about, you know, people betting and, you know, about the draft and so on and so forth. When I worked at ABC Radio nationally in New York, the guy who ran the department was Shelby Whitfield. And yeah. I think that you knew Shelby.
He fired
me. I knew him real well.
He fired
me. Yeah, sure, because you did the Washington Senators games for so many years. So every day, Shelby was about 5'8 and maybe 280, 300. He would stagger back in from drinking his lunch every day to the office. He'd go over to our old-fashioned wire machine, and he'd look at the prices on the afternoon's Major League Baseball games. I said, Shelby, what are you doing? Well, he's a huge, you know, degenerate gambler betting baseball. So now, with no baseball for these people to bet, yeah, they're just concocting things kind of related to sports to bet on, aren't they?
Or else I'm betting on British darts and stuff like that. If you're that desperate.
And Shelby, by the way, was the official ass kisser of Ted Williams with us. I mean, if Ted would have stopped too quick, Shelby would have broken his nose.
Oh yeah, yeah. Shelby had commentaries on ABC because he ran the thing. Yeah. And what he would do is he would go in and he would tape them for you old broadcast veterans such as Eli and Denny and me. He would use the old fashioned little reel tape, that tiny thin brown tape. He would flub so many words, especially after lunch, that he would spend the next hour after his 2-minute commentary with an old fashioned razor blade, slicing his little mistakes out of the tape and splicing it back together again. It really was quite comical. You had to be there to see it.
You watch Brandon edit audio and the things you can do by speeding it up, slowing it down, moving this part there, that part there, you know, fading this in, fading that out, the incredible control. And if I like to show Brandon some of my old tapes that I saved from ABX in the old days with the white tape and all the splices in it. It's just amazing how, you know, And I watch TV now, and you'll watch, you know, CNN or Fox or MSNBC. I don't want to tell people what I watch because then we get into politics. And you'll see 4, 5, 6 people on the screen at once. You know, to get a live shot back in 1981, it was to get somebody to talk to Jim Brandstetter from the palace, you know, 20 miles away in a live shot was an incredible technological mountain you had to climb. And now everybody from all over the world, they got their Skype, their WebEx, their Zoom, and everybody can be everywhere. It's just amazing how you can just bring people in and everything's in everybody's lap at the same time. It's if you've been where we've been, look, where you're splicing tape and can't do live shots and got to show a game 2 days ago because you didn't get the highlights in until now. What a different world.
And folks, you know why we don't run out of topics as opposed to all the other talk shows now, which are doing the who's better, LeBron or Jordan, all that kind of stuff. If we wanted to, the three of us, we could do one entire show and tell nothing but Jim Brandstetter stories. We could just tell Brandy stories for an entire hour. Now let's go to the guest. Oh, it's Jim Brandstetter himself. Hey, Brandy.
Oh, man.
That's true.
You know, do you feel bad for Vince McMahon? Did you see the story that he's being sued by Oliver Luck, who was, you know, running his league? And think of it. He planned this league for years. It's on for 2 or 3 weeks. He's got to dump the league, declare bankruptcy. It's just the
it's amazing.
The devastation and just what. The rug that's been pulled out from under so many people.
Think about this devastation. I mean, we've redefined the word. I mean, 27 million people now have applied for unemployment. 27 million people. I mean, the devastation, we'll never know the full extent of it. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg right now.
And I'll tell you, Denny, I'll tell you three people who applied for unemployment and were quickly shut down. That would be my daughter, Kelly, her husband, Art, and Art's brother, Skip. They have a home improvement business in suburban Detroit. Yeah. They ain't helping people like that.
No.
What they do is for people like my daughter, they say, well, we have small business loans for you folks. Yeah. So you come out of whenever this nightmare is over, you're a small business person. You come out. How much in debt are you? How are you going to pay that money back? When are you going to pay it back? So it's great that people are getting unemployment, but so many, many other people who need money are not eligible for it.
And all of a sudden, the banks want to go back into their credit qualifications and everything else. And that's not the way the deal was written by the Trump administration originally. Whatever's changed, something has changed dramatically, because I know guys that are seriously wealthy who can't get a bank loan right now. So although some of them don't need it.
You know, the wheels of bureaucracy turn.
Yeah.
And to throw a monkey wrench like this, example, a woman I work with at Yaldo, I guess they went to her 2018 tax return or 2017, whatever it was, and she had a different address. So her check got sent to somewhere else to get it back, and she needs it desperately. So there's a million stories like that. And in fairness to the federal government, how you can get a check and the right check to 300 million people and businesses is something that just can't be done in a week or two when you expect to do it cleanly. It's just, and here we are. We were just chatting sports. You forget for a moment what's really going on in the world. You kind of get caught up, and we're going to talk to Rick Barry and have a great time. And, you know, it's peaceful here in my house. It's not that life is not that different. Yet, as we said a few days ago, in another place, 5, 6, 10 miles away, it's a whole different world. Yeah. So it's I kind of feel guilty that I'm kind of outside the fray a little bit. I don't know. It's just me.
But will you pick up lunch? No.
Hey, David Hall and Hall Financial care about the community. That's why the team at Hall Financial is working from home around the clock to help people save money by refinancing. Great time to do it. People are refinancing right now, today. And if you haven't in the last year, you can lower your monthly payments, keep some money in your pocket to help you through these turbulent times. By refinancing, you can probably skip up to two or three payments. If you're worried about the coronavirus, don't. Your home can be appraised without someone stepping foot inside. They're doing it with drive-by appraisals. Hall Financial Service, fastest in the business. That's why they have nearly 1,500 five-star reviews for Michigan homeowners. We read one the other day from somebody who wrote to us. Go to their webpage and click on the logo to get started, or go to 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Where do you start with Rick Barry, Hall of Famer, named one of the greatest 50 players of all time back when the league had their 50-year celebration of the 90s, only player to ever lead the NCAA, the ABA, and the NBA in scoring. He was the Rookie of the Year, second season, the scoring champ, and MVP. On it goes. He was a final MVP, too. And, which I want to talk a lot later, the first star player to defy the reserve clause and jump to the ABA. He had that two-hand underhand free throw, retiring in 1980 as the NBA's all-time free throw leader. And he was the only one that did it at 90%. Now, he was known for his scoring prowess, but Barry was much more. Here is a clip from the 75 playoffs that attest to his all-round game.
Chet Walker has the ball knocked away by Rick Barry. Another facet of Rick Barry's play that a lot of people aren't aware of. He was the number one player in the NBA in steals this year. Here comes Golden State on the run. Up court is Mullins on the left flank. They go to Barry to Mullins. And Jeff Mullins lays the ball in off the run.
Boy, that was a super pass by Rick Barry then. He could have taken it in for the layup. It just shows you what an unselfish player he is.
And unselfish with his time by agreeing to join us today. Rick, thanks for joining us. How's the family? How's the, you were such a basketball leg. How's Brent, John, Drew, and your youngest Kenyon? How's the family doing in these tumultuous times?
Well, thank God everybody's good. Everybody's healthy. You know, all my boys have had great lives. I mean, I still pinch myself to think. I was hoping that one of my boys would be good enough to maybe play basketball and to have all five of them get Division I college scholarships, all five of them play professionally, and I still have one active. My son Canyon was with the G League team for the Timberwolves and also on the USA 3x3 national team last year. The only gold medal the USA ever won in basketball was 3x3 World Cup, and they won that last year, and he was the leading scorer in four of the seven games, and actually was just ready to go over in March to play. He was chosen to play on the qualifying team for the Olympics. And they were in training, and then they, of course, canceled it because of the COVID situation. And he's still on that team and looking forward to next year going over to see if they can qualify for the Olympics and perhaps become an Olympian. So very blessed in that regard. Basketball has been great to me. But just, you know, you've got, you know, one of the great players that did one of the most amazing things, winning 30 games. And Denny knows that, you know, as a parent, you hope that your kids can do well, but to have them follow in your footsteps and all have success and have it be a great part of your life, it's a pretty neat thing. But baseball, Denny, really was my best sport. I was the best baseball player in high school. I was a two-time all-state player. I was a pitcher like you. And but it just, for me, I had a bad run in my junior, my sophomore year at a JB. I'm pitching and batting 500. I played every position, and I'm better than anybody on the team. I told the coach, I said, Coach, this is not the major leagues. I mean, when I'm not pitching, I want to play. I can hit better than anybody. Next game, I pitch. I go 1-for-2. Next game, I'm on the bench, and so I quit. And I guess I should send them presents because I went out and focused all my energies on basketball, and the varsity coach asked me to play baseball the next year, and I said, yeah, but only if I'm going to be able to play when I don't pitch. And he let me do that, and I wound up making All-State 2 years in a row, but I lost my passion for the game and really got into basketball.
And you know, that defines, it defines an athlete. An athlete, I've always believed, between a certain age of about 15 and 22, 25, if you're really a super athlete, you can play just about any score in any team and any game and do it well.
Yeah, I think if you're blessed with God-given natural abilities and doing things, it's just a matter of being exposed. And that's why I tell kids, I said, look, just expose your children to all the various sports.
Yeah.
Don't try to push them into anything. Let them make the decision as to which one they have a passion for, and then support them in that. And because you got to have a passion in life, and nothing better than, I think, than having a passion. And if it's sports, because it's a wonderful thing that you can do for a long period of time. But if it's music, if it's science, whatever it may be, expose them to it and support your kids in that endeavor.
You know, you had all these kids that played the NBA, great athletes, great kids. They've turned out super well. And I'm thinking every time one of my grandkids got a 70 or one of my kids got at least a 70 in high school, I was excited. And here you got four or five kids that wind up in the NBA. I mean, what a thrill.
Listen, I have one son. He has his master's in nuclear engineering.
Oh, my God.
Hey, listen, 1968, Denny makes $30,000 to win 31 games with the Tigers. At the same time, you jump leagues. I know it's something that you later regretted, but the fact is you're only 2 years into your career. You've been the MVP, and you jump across to the ABA because you don't get the contract you want from the Warriors. The point being is that, you know, Franklin Muley, who was the owner, said this defection could shatter the whole concept of professional sports in the U.S. Well, he was right. It did, but for the better. Think of it. You were a pariah for just doing what any worker in America should be able to do, is offer his services and play and work where he wants to play. What a different age we're in today, aren't we?
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think if people who are listeners understand, the Reserve Clause basically was a contract of slavery almost. And once you sign that first contract, and, you know, and obviously later on Kirk Flood challenged it in baseball, is that the next year, if you don't sign the offer that they give you, you're obligated to play at 90% of the salary of the original contract you signed.
That's right.
And it continues on and on and on. I mean, it was absolutely ludicrous. And so I opened up the doors for players to be able to become free agents and to start the bidding war for it. I didn't really take advantage of play one side against the other. I should have done what I was accused of doing. I would have made a lot more money probably, but it did open things up for the players, and it's only right. That's what I kept trying to tell people when I was there. I said, look, if you're working for, let's say you're a salesman working for a company, and another company decides they want to have you because they like that you're really good at what you're doing, and they offer you an opportunity to go and work for them for more money, you wouldn't be able to go if you had signed the Reserve Clause contract.
That's right.
Yeah, for sure, it's absurd, and yet you were viewed, and this is how the owners had all the fans and the media on their side. You were viewed as money hungry, as selfish, and yet why weren't the Warriors viewed as selfish? They didn't match the offer that Pat Boone, by the way, did in the ABA right across the river or the bridge. And think of it, $500,000, 3 years. Back then, that was the biggest contract in sports. Koufax and Drysdale were trying to get that money when they held out in 66 and they couldn't get it. So really,
well, I wish it was that much money. It wasn't that much money. Basically, I mean, the contract was going to be for $75,000, which was, you know, obviously good money back in those days. I remember when I came in the league, I think there were only four players in the NBA making $100,000. So my goal was to become good enough to be able to make $100,000. But the thing is that the Warriors they basically screwed up. People said, oh, I have no sense of value. I mean, no loyalty, whatever. Hey, I was loyal. I told Pat Boone, I said, look, Pat, give me your best offer. I'm going to go back to the Warriors. I'm not going to tell them what you offered me, and I'm going to tell them to give me their best offer. If their best offer is anything close to yours, I'm going to stay. That's the bottom line, and that's exactly what I did. And the Warriors basically, they lowballed me, and then they came back and gave me another offer, and that's the one that went out in the newspapers to how much they offered me. But they didn't really offer me that initially, and I just was a person of my word. And to be honest with you, I really was looking forward to getting to go. I thought I was going to get to play for my then father-in-law, who was my college coach, who helped me so much to get ready for the pros, because I did something that's rare in basketball. I don't know if you can name very many players who came out of college, first year in the pros, and made first team All-Pro. And I did that. And I did that because I was in college with a coach who played pro-style basketball, was a great pro player himself. And I basically had 4 years, even though he only played varsity 3 years back then, I had 4 years of playing in the minor leagues in baseball to get myself ready for going into the majors. And that's kind of what happened. I told people, they look strangely at me when I tell them, I said, let me tell you something. It was easier for me to play in the NBA than it was in college, because in college, every team had their entire defense set to try to shut me down. When I went to the pros, I had one guy guard me. I said, oh my God, I only got one guy guard me. This is unbelievable.
Rick, you were always a really, really cerebral player. Your playing career ends and you go on a coaching odyssey. You become a coach and you're working all over the minor leagues. And I'm thinking at that time, what's wrong with this picture? Why isn't Rick Berry an NBA head coach instead? Were you blackballed as a result of what happened?
I don't know if I was blackballed, but I was never given the opportunity. I never got a legitimate interview to coach, even though I went and did the minor league stuff. I said, hey, okay, I'll go out and I'll try this. I did it myself to try to say, okay, do I like this? I was doing a lot of broadcasting stuff before that, and I really enjoyed that. Thought I did a good job in that, and then got screwed in that because of, you know, people who, you know, anyway, that's a whole other story. But anyway, so I go and I do the coaching. I said, you know what? I really like this. What I liked most about it wasn't necessarily the coaching and the game part of it. I liked the teaching part, because to go out and teach, I can't spend time and waste time on somebody who has no talent. Okay. Like my wife teaches kids, and she was an All-American basketball player. And so she helps kids out. I don't have the patience for that. I can tell in like 2 minutes whether or not somebody has any talent. And if they have talent, to get to work with them and to take that talent and to refine that talent and really help them become good at what they're doing, that was what was exciting for me. You know, the other part of the game, I mean, it was nice to do that and being a part of a team again. And so I really enjoyed it. And I think I had some pretty decent success. In the time that I wound up losing my one job, I had two guys on my team that made the All-Star team in the league that I was coaching in. And I told the owners of the team, I want to trade them. They said, wait, but they're All-Star players. I said, I don't care. I said, one of them is an alcoholic and the other one smokes dope all the time. I said, I don't want them on my team. I said, I have two other guys that are just as good. Well, they don't trade them. The two other guys that I had, they trade those guys away. Both of those guys, they got traded away, wound up playing in the NBA.
You were an excellent broadcaster, too. I was watching the day that you became the first victim of PC in the history of this country when they didn't have that term. When you said Bill Russell had a watermelon grin on his face, I thought it was funny. Talk about that and the reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean, people overreact to things and doing it. I mean, I said, well, great. If I said that because if he was a white guy, it's okay. If I said, you're the one that's racist. You're the one that's thinking about it being, you know, black people and watermelons and stuff. I said, what the hell is that? I said, you know, big deal. So if I said Cheshire Cat, it would have been okay. I mean, big deal. I mean, you know, I mean, so it's just amazing how people could be so sensitive about things. And unfortunately, at that time, Bill was going through a difficult time, and we wound up actually becoming very good friends. In fact, Bill invited me when he finally decided to let the Celtics retire his jersey. He invited me to his jersey retirement in Boston. So, I mean, people make so much out of that. And I've talked to a lot of people about it that, in fact, somebody was on the phone that I was doing a deal with yesterday, and this guy said, well, I couldn't believe I worked with Rick forever at KNBR doing stuff, and I heard all these things I heard of him. He actually was really a good guy. I said, well, be careful. You're going to ruin my reputation because, I mean, I really am a good person, and it's yet these guys pick it up. And the thing that probably bothered me more than anything that anybody has ever written about me, and I've never really met him, and I hope I do someday because he owes me an apology, and that's Bill Simmons. Bill Simmons wrote in his book that I was a dick. Really? Anyway, Bill Simmons has never even met me. And then I see all these quotes by my teammates, and I showed my wife now, who wasn't my wife back in those days, and I said, honey, look, here's the quote that my teammates said, and here's what's being used in the books. They took partial quotes to use it to reinforce the story about me being this guy that everybody hated, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's one of those things that you learn to live with, and, you know, did it hurt me? Yeah, it hurt my feelings. There's no question about it, because they portrayed me as a person. And I know I'm not a person. The thing I get by in is that I know who I am, and the people who know me and my friends know who I am. And so, unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there who think I am a dick, which is sad.
Did that come from maybe he misunderstood your competitiveness? Because as good as you were, you had to be exceptionally competitive. I mean, I know the feeling. And every time you walked out there, you felt like you could beat the world.
Yeah, well, also, here's the biggest thing. When I went out there, I didn't go out there to make friends with you. I went out there to kick your ass.
Right, absolutely.
This is a professional sport. I'm being paid to play well and to win games and to beat the opponent. So does that mean that I'm that type of person when I leave it? Because let's face it, when you're out there, that's a different world.
Sure.
That's not who you are as a person. When you leave the playing field or the court or whatever it is, you go into the real world. That's not the real world. And you have to do what you need to do to succeed in that world. And that's what I did. And the greatest example of it is how it works against you, is that for some stupid reason, in 1975, they decide to let the players vote for the MVP of the league. It's usually the writers who do, right? So not only, I mean, I have a great season. We win, we win the championship. I just have a great season in 1975. And I get picked. I'm not even first or second in the MVP voting because the players didn't like me because I didn't try to make friends.
Right.
And so it was so stupid to let players vote because players let emotion get involved. And that year, the writers voted for the All-Pro team. I was the only unanimous decision. So in my mind, I know that had they had the vote for MVP, that I would have won the MVP that year. But in the record book, I didn't.
You know, you were a contrarian and a bit eccentric, which is what we all like because that's what we are. And so we appreciate that about you. And you were a contrarian. We got to get into the free throw thing. You know, in your era, two guys shot underhand. Wilt, one of the worst free throw shooters in history, and you, who retired as the greatest free throw shooter in history. And I love this little feature you did with Red Auerbach back in the mid-70s, showing Red your free throw technique.
So I take the three bounces, arms hang down, my knees are bent, I'm relaxed, cock the wrists, follow through.
All right, now that, as we all know, is a very, very unique style. This is the way free throws were shot 40 years ago. That was the only way it was shot. And here's a guy, one of the great, great players in the game, the greatest free throw shooter in the game, shooting as they did 40 years ago.
Which is now 85 years ago. And, you know, I got to say, Rick, you were incredibly successful, Hall of Fame, all the scoring records. You failed to get underhanded free throw shooting to be the way that everybody did it. How come you could never get it to catch on despite, and your son, by the way, I think hit 43 straight, Kenyon did in college. So it works, but maybe just not for everybody, huh?
Well, it could work for everybody if they're willing to take the time and the effort to do it. I don't understand why. I guess the egos get into it. People are reluctant to do it. I mean, it makes no sense because back when I was taught that by my dad, who was a semi-pro player and coach, he said, I said, Dad, I can't do this. This is the way girls shoot. And girls did shoot that way. And so I said, they're all going to make fun of me. And he said, son, and I remember these words like they were yesterday, God rest his soul, son, they can't make fun of you if you're making them. And I remember when I gave it a sincere effort, thank God he was relentless because I didn't want to do it. I was about a 75% free throw shooter. And so before my either junior or senior year, I think it was before my junior year in high school, I really gave it some effort. To be honest, I only did it to get him off my back. And he was driving me nuts about this. But I gave it a real effort. And as I started doing it, I said, wow, this is pretty good. And so that next season, I used it. I shot over 80%. And I remember in the first away game, it was in Scotch Plains, New Jersey, and I can hear it so clearly. A guy in the stands yells during the course of the game, hey, Barry, you big sissy, shooting like that. And I heard so crystal clear, the guy next to him says, what are you making fun of him for? He doesn't miss. And so I was cool from that point on. But as you heard when in Red talking about it, I changed my technique. I actually think, I would have been still the best free throw shooter had I shot the way that I shot my last 6 years. I took the risk. When you hear that cocking the wrist, I took that out of it. I analyzed it and looked at it. I said, maybe I can make this better. And so I took the wrist out of it. And by doing so, my last 6 years, I shot over 92%, which would be the highest of all time. And I probably would have shot even a higher percentage because my early years, I was shooting over 10 free throws a game. And I think I could have had some crazy records back in those days and made 100 in a row, which I always was mad that I didn't do it. I had the record at 60 one time during competition. But my last 6 years, over 92, but my last 2 years, I shot over 94%. Wow. In fact, 3 years ago, Andre Drummond from the Pistons missed 23 free throws in one game. Oh. In my last two seasons, I missed 19.
My God. Bob, before you ask your question, let me just say this. When I did I met you at a symposium. It was in Colorado Springs or whatever it was. It was a sports thing about 5 years ago. Andy Appleby put on at the Broadmoor. And you said also that you think that you can putt better if you do it through your legs. And this is another
part of your belief. Not through your legs. It's off to the side. You can't putt through your legs. It's illegal. Sam Snead did that croquet style and they made it illegal. You can't straddle the line of the putt. But what I do is I just lean over to the side and I hold the putter straight down so it's up and down. I have a putter that's got a little rounded bottom, but I can move it up so it's in a straight shaft, which you can't have a straight shaft according to the rules, but just making this adjustment. And then I just do it that way. It's like a pendulum. I can literally take it and let it swing back and forth. And you're looking straight down the line. And the bottom line is that you're going to have more success because here's the deal. If I said to people, take this ball and roll it to the hole, who's going to stand there sideways and do it?
Hey Rick, the first time I ever met and interviewed you, you got a break for a minute here,
yeah,
Eli?
We got to say goodbye to our radio listeners, but this is a podcast. Thanks for listening to WCWA and WDFN. You can download the podcast, hear the rest of the Rick Barry interview. You've been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Go ahead, Bob. Go ahead.
Okay, Rick, the first time that I ever met and interviewed you, and I think it probably goes for Eli too, was 45 years ago when the Golden State Warriors played back-to-back playoff series against the Pistons when the Pistons were still at Cobo Arena in Detroit. A lot of old Detroiters remember that, like to hear you talk about it, and want to hear you talk about three kids you had with you on that team, Robert Parrish. We know what happened to him. And two guys I thought were such great players, so underrated, and few remember them, Phil Smith, Gus Williams.
And by the way, Greg Kelser asked me to ask you about Phil Smith, his friend who died in 2002. Answer Bob's question. That's a good question.
Very sad about Phil, because we had that year when we won the championship in 75, and it's really rare to have this happen in basketball, especially, and probably in all sports, to have two rookies be integral parts of your success. It was Keith Wilkes at the time who became Jamal Wilkes. And then Phil Smith, and both of them were really, really good players, and they were an important part of our success. Keith gets Rookie of the Year, they were great, and Phil turned out to become, wound up being an all-star player, and unfortunately we lost Phil when he was in his 40s. He had cancer, and it was really, really sad, but he was a heck of a player. I still remember Phil was part of the greatest pass that I had ever made in my life. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It's the Oakland Coliseum. I was, it's a north to south kind of setup. We were on the north side of the arena where our basket was, and our bench was on the left side. I knocked the ball away and I ran towards half court away from our basket. And everybody's running down the court. And when Phil saw that I was going to get it towards half court on the opposite side of the court, I saw Phil through the corner of my eye running towards the basket. So as I ran to get the ball near half court, I bent over and like the football center, I just took the ball with two hands. I hiked it through my legs and just threw it up towards the basket. And it happened to be perfect right to the side of the basket. Phil caught it with two hands and dunked it. I probably couldn't make that pass again, even if I wanted to make that pass again. And Phil was a part of that one.
Hey, we got Dave Bing. Speaking of old players, we have Dave Bing coming on next Thursday. You played against us, against him.
Great player.
Give us a little bit on him that we can throw back at him. What was your...
Well, just a great person, mid-range jump shooter, athletic as could be, really understood how to play the game. I feel sorry for him that he had to suffer through being mayor of Detroit for so many years. But he's a great guy. He was one of the guys that helped get the Players Association put in place for the NBA. And I know Dave quite well, really have a great deal of respect and admiration for him. So you'll have a really good time. And what I remember about Cobo, though, you brought that up. I remember going to a game with Cobo all one time. They had some tough fans, and it shows you how times have changed. I remember one guy behind the bench who was a big fan. He used to give us all a bunch of major griefs behind him, but in a good way, not an obnoxious guy.
Leon the Barber. It was Leon the Barber, the famous Leon the Barber, yes.
What was it? Was it Leon who carried the gun?
Yeah.
Had a gun?
Yeah.
Came to the, yeah, that was, yeah, it was Leon the Barber. I remember him.
Two things real quick. Number one, are you associated with any organization at all right now? And I've got to ask you the question. Did you enjoy wearing those short shorts?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I would hate to wear these long shorts, man. First of all, I couldn't shoot the free throw the way I did it because my son Canyon, who I taught how to do it and wanted to do it, had to make an adjustment because when you bend down the way I did it, it would hit all of that extra freaking material and you couldn't shoot it that way. So he has to hold it out away from his body a little bit more. So, yeah, no, and plus, I mean, that's just extra weight and baggage to hang around. I would hate to have to play with those things.
We have a big argument now because you got the Jordan series going on ESPN, and the conversation is who is the greatest, Jordan or LeBron? Who is the better player in your view?
They're both great. It's always something that people bring up. You know, oh, he was the greatest this and greatest that. And I think Denny will agree 100% with me on this. You cannot pick the greatest player in a sport if it's a team sport because you have positions that you play and the skills required. What are you going to compare? You going to compare Denny to a catcher or Denny to a center fielder? I mean, that's ridiculous. Same thing in basketball. You can't compare a two guard to it's a close thing. A two and a three are very similar, but you know, but the skills required and what you have to do are different. They're not all the same. You certainly can't compare Wilt Chamberlain to LeBron James or to Michael Jordan or to Magic Johnson because the skills are different. So pick the player at his position and then have a debate about it. As I said, if I were playing and I had to pick a team to do something and I had to pick five guys that I think were the best. I mean, if I had to play the game myself, I wouldn't have LeBron on the team because I'd be playing three. But LeBron would be my three and Michael would be my two.
Rick, I got question. I got a better question for you, Rick, to follow up on what Eli asked you. You pioneered the point forward position, essentially invented it before Larry Bird, before Scottie Pippen. So I'm talking with Gus Johnson. I know you know who Gus is, the play-by-play guy. Everybody does now.
Michael.
And I told Gus, I said, Gus asked me, just BSing on the phone. He says, well, who's coming on the show? I said, well, we're going to have Rick Barry Thursday. Gus says to me, man, Rick Barry was the baddest white boy I ever saw on a basketball court. Okay. And I said, yeah,
I guess so.
Larry came along. Gus says, no, Rick Barry was better. So why don't you settle that one? Who was better? Larry Bird.
You're talking about a different Gus Johnson. I was talking about Honeycomb Gus Johnson who played with the Bullets and all.
No, not that Gus Johnson.
I know. So I know what Gus Johnson you're talking about. When you started saying and you talked to him, I said, well, that's Gus Johnson's dad. So, and I'll tell you what, he was an amazing player. I mean, he was kind of like LeBron James. He had that kind of a body like LeBron. I mean, he was crazy. But that's very nice of him to say. I've had a lot of people tell that. And my friend Clifford Ray always tells me stuff. And he says, man, the brothers thought you could really play B. He calls me B. And so it's actually great respect, you know, that they feel that way about me. Because the bottom line, I grew up playing with the black players because I used to go to a place called Brophy Field in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And all the black players and kids were down there. And we played together. And you know, and I remember years ago, if you remember, they used to have this thing saying, well, he's a black who plays white. He's a white who plays black. It's BS. What it is that you play the game a certain way to have natural skill and ability and athleticism. Because it wasn't like Wes Unseld played like a white player. No, Wes Unseld played like a big guy who wasn't really quick and didn't have super great athleticism, but still was a great player. Had nothing to do with the color of your skin.
Sure. Yeah, which proves the old PC thing that caught you, because we accept Gus saying he was the greatest white boy. You can't say somebody's the greatest black boy. So it's too bad that you get caught up in these politically correct sayings, because Gus is a great guy too. Hey, when I did my thing with you at the Broadmoor 5 years ago, you got into a thing and I kind of fought you on it, but you're probably right. But I said, you felt the players in your day knew how to play better. They didn't have the training benefits, but they didn't understand how the game is played, which is a pretty broad statement. They don't know how to pass, move, cut. So, and has the 3-point shot changed the game? And were players back in your day more schooled in how to, quote, play the game than they are today?
Well, just to set it straight, I definitely was correct. You said I might have been correct. I definitely am correct. But I didn't say everybody. I just said a lot of the players don't really know what to do with the talent that they have. And it gets back to one of the principles that I try to tell young people when I speak to them. When you get into a profession, it is essential that you learn the fundamental principles and concept of what it is that you're going to do, regardless if it's sports, music, science, whatever it may be, because that's the foundation that you build on. And as I explained to them, you cannot put a skyscraper on a small foundation. It will topple over. So even if you're gifted and have incredible natural talent and ability that God gave you, you're not going to fully maximize that potential if you don't have that foundation and understand how to use those amazing skills to their fullest. And And there are guys in the NBA today that aren't as good as they should be because they don't know how to play the game the right way and utilize all of those skills. And that's the point that I was making. And I really, truly believe that. I'll give you a great example of this, and you'll relate to this, Danny. So I had my youngest son when I was doing the Goose Gossage lives where I live in Colorado Springs. And so my son was going to play baseball and pitch. I said, Goose, would you mind giving my son some pointers? So I brought him over to Goose. And so I'm there, I'm watching them listen, and Goose is telling him things that I'm saying to myself. I said to Goose, why didn't I have a coach when I was in high school tell me the things that you're telling me? My God, I would have been so much better a pitcher if somebody had told me all these things that you just told me that I didn't even know about. Perfect example. I mean, he is a great player. He knows the game, a Hall of Famer. I mean, you have to learn from the best, but you have to learn how to utilize the God-given talents that you were, and some fundamental principles and little things like that are so critical and so important.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is that when you've got some people who are very talented and they stay together for 5, 6, 7 years, it makes a difference as far as their development goes. Additionally, the minor, especially in baseball, they concentrate a lot more on the structure of the game, of the structure of the players and the fundamentals. You mentioned it early. You said fundamentals. And that's what it's all about. And this may sound silly, but hitting a cutoff man, button, hitting and running and
hitting. Thank you.
You learn all those things. That's the fundamentals of the game. That isn't the game. That's the, if you can do those things, you're going to be a good player.
Yeah, ball man relationship in basketball. Don't my father always said, he taught us to go ahead when you ran back down the court. You just don't run down the court and not look. You run back, but you keep a view. He taught us to try to run backwards so that you can see what's happening, or at least look over your shoulder and see if something happens that you can react to it. But if your head's turned, you never see that. You always have to have ball man relationship if you're playing the game. That's a simple fundamental thing. But there's so many players today. If you're watching it, I could do an NBA game when I did stuff and I do the replays. And I would look and say, look at the weak side. He has no idea where the ball is. He should have been dropped in. It should have been in the help position, but he wasn't. Yeah. Those are the little things I'm talking about that take you to a different level and make you a better player.
My last question, I don't know about the other guys, is that we had Al Kaline. We did an interview after Al Kaline, who was Denny's old teammate. But
terrible.
One thing he said, which kind of surprised me, because they won the World Series in 68. He said, my regret is I wish we had won more titles than I played on better teams. You played on some pretty good teams. Sometimes you wasted 4 years essentially in the ABA where you did win a title, but you got hurt a lot over there. Do you think that, I mean, with all you accomplished in your career, Hall of Fame on down, do you regret that you didn't play on more teams and had that as part of your legacy for great teams?
Well, about regret it. I mean, I would have liked to have done that. I mean, because it's about winning. Like when people ask, the only ring that I wear, I have a Hall of Fame ring, I have a top 50 ring, and I have a championship ring. The only ring I wear is my championship ring. It's a team game. It's not about individual awards and honors. And so I would love to have been able to be on more championship teams. And one of the biggest disappointments I had was not winning back-to-back championships. We won in 75 and we lost in 76 in the finals of the Western Conference in 7 games at home. That thing haunts me to this day. And so, yeah, I definitely would love to have played more. Now, with that being said, it's unfortunate that when they go and they evaluate people, and they give them rankings as to how good a player they were, they give them credit for having been on championship teams. What the hell is that? This is a team game.
Fair.
I mean, if you don't have great players, you're not going to win championships. Or if you don't have a team that does what we were able to do in 75, still the greatest upset in the history of the NBA Finals, that's never gotten recognition. No 30-30 ever done. No documentary ever done about the greatest upset in the history of the NBA Finals, and they've never done anything about it, giving credit to my teammates. I mean, it's really disappointing to me that they haven't done that. But that's what it comes down to. Why should you get more credit because you were lucky enough to have great teammates and win a bunch of championships so you get recognized as a better player?
Couldn't disagree with that at all. By the way, it was the Washington Bullets of Wes Unsell that you guys swept in 1975. Anybody else got? Should we let Rick go? Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think we're wearing Rick out about that.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Rick, thanks for joining us.
I love to talk about the game. It's been so good to me. So and my family. So it's a pleasure to meet you over the phone, Denny. And I wish all of your listeners continued good health. Stay healthy during these crazy times that we're in.
We'll you too, and we'd love to have you on again.
And by the way, not only were you and Denny contemporaries, he was born March 29th, 1944, about five hours after you were born.
One day after, were you at 44?
Yeah, Yeah, 1944. Really? Born in my mother's bed in Chicago, Illinois.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm one day older than you. How about that? Yeah, like
that. Thanks again, Rick.
I was born at 3:30 in the morning.
Appreciate it.
I think I was born at 2:30 in the morning.
Well, we're twins.
Unbelievable.
All right. So long, Rick. Thanks again.
Take care.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Super.
He's so great always, and you and I have interviewed him many times. He's almost like Dick Vitale. Ask him a question, and he's going to entertain the hell out of you for the next 45 minutes without ever hearing another question.
Which you can see why players resented him. He's cocky. He's smart. He knows it. He got those razor. I remember reading an article in Sports Illustrated in 65. When he led the nation in scoring as a senior at Miami, and he got these, I remember reading he got a $7 razor cut. Now, back then, I paid 80 cents for a haircut. Yeah, I'm saying, who is this guy? You know, he scores 37 points a game. He's this good-looking Rick Perry.
What? Your personal hero was Muhammad Ali. And in that same vein, you braggart, you can't say that stuff. Ali always said, it ain't bragging if you can back it up. And Rick Berry could back up that cockiness.
Sure could. And he was that's why I played the thing in the beginning. He was a great all-round player. He was a point forward, like you said. I'm glad you brought that up. He could have played any position. All right. How about
a mailbag?
Let me say goodbye.
The mailbag. There we go. This is how you get on the mailbag, folks. I know a lot of you really, really enjoy doing that. You let us know what you're thinking at asknofilter@gmail.com. You can call us or you can text us. And that number again is 760-89-BALLS. And if you want to, you can tweet any of the three of us at Eli Zarrett, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. Regular listener Gaspar Genovese is with us again. I appreciate you guys keeping it interesting, even with nothing happening in the world of sports. Got three things he wants to mention. And I'm with him on number two, Denny. Wait till we get to this. Number one, random thought. I recognize the logistical headache it would be to get some of the pro sports teams in one place to play for TV in empty arenas. But I have to believe the logistics of keeping a Costco, Walmart, and other large business where people have to go to work each day is pretty difficult, too. Got to believe that the players and the support personnel would have it much better off and be much safer than the retail employees, let alone the hospital employees now, who've been showing up for work throughout this crisis. I'm thinking the distraction they would provide by playing would be a national service. So why not reopen it out of a sense of national pride?
Well, I think what I'd like to see, and I may be going off to the side here a little bit, but what I'd like to see is all four of our teams in the city offer all of the nurses and doctors free tickets for a year at all the ball games. Let them have, maybe not every game, but the vast majority of games, I think somebody should do that. One or all four teams, I think it'd be a wonderful gesture. What these people have done is nothing more than a miracle. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of miracles. I mean, we hear about so many people escaping this virus now. They're coming out of the hospital. Well, I just heard a number the other day, over 300,000 people have been cured from the virus. I mean, and we don't hear about those numbers, but those are miraculous numbers that somehow, some way, these good people hung in there and did their thing and got these people to go home. It's unbelievable, Denny, Bob.
Denny, we all agree with what you said about the tremendous people doing this. That wasn't the question. He says, why wouldn't we open the leagues again and begin playing sports as a national service right now? Do you think we should do that? Should the leagues be open? When should they be open? Any idea?
I don't think we should look at it until June. I think at the earliest you can look at it is June. I think a number of governors have just extended the blanket again to keep people locked down. I think you got to go along with the science and with the people who we elected to call these shots. And if we respect them and if we respect all of the research that's gone into this, then we will do what they suggest.
Yeah, we talked about this with Arnie last week. We shouldn't go over it. I was going to bring it up early with the NHL thing. I gave a list of everybody from Zamboni drivers to ball boys of what it would take to keep everybody safe. And, of course, everybody wants sports back, but it's the antithesis of social distancing. These players, this is a sweaty ball. They're with each other. And one guy comes down with a virus. They got to be tested every day. It's just, sadly so, it's just a logistical and a physical nightmare.
All right, Denny, here's point number two.
Okay.
I totally agree with Gasper, who has a big problem with you on this, and I know Eli does too. At the beginning of the last podcast, Denny promised us he had some inside information on the startup of the baseball season, but he never shared it. I told you at the time, you got some info? Tell us what it is. He said, oh, I'll do it later on in the show. And you never did.
Yeah, we never got back to it. We never got back to it. But I promise you on the Monday show, I'll get to it.
Oh, God, I can't believe you're doing this again.
Usually you tease something from one segment to the next. He teases something a week in advance. Okay.
Let me tell you something. It's great stuff. Some of it's come out now, but it's great stuff.
By the way, you quoted, you read from Gasper Genovese, the last thing he wrote, so that Eli can continue to drive Lincoln SUVs I donated $2 to the podcast. Trust me, I feel we got about another $125 from some
That cheap SOB. Now tell everybody else how they can donate, and we're going to give the money to Gleaners, right?
This is just to pay our production costs. Otherwise, we have to shell out every week, and I'm usually the one that it falls back on. And then, we want to be able to pay our producers and our production costs, but yes, you can go to the donate button, and even $2 is fine. In fact, if you loyal listeners gave $2 a month, we'd be thrilled. Anyway,
D-Champ Green, he goes by D-Champ Green. He was with us last week because he had a great comment, and now he's with us again via Twitter. I worked for a guy that had a jar you put $1 in if you were late to his meetings. No Filter Sports should do something similar. $5 every time you bring up the coronavirus. Eli would be broke in no time, and no donate button would be needed by you guys if you did that. Now here we go with Stefan DeBuscher, who writes, it's ludicrous to think that Miguel Cabrera is better than George Kell at third base on the all-time Detroit Tigers team. And I think there was a serious omission of Mickey Cochrane at the catcher position. Well, Stefan, that is ludicrous. Miggy was a much better hitter than George was, though obviously not as good defensively as Kell. And Stefan, Mickey Cochrane was essentially a Philadelphia Athletic. Of his 13-year career in the major league, in the major leagues, Cochrane played the first nine with Mr. Mack, as George Kell used to call him on TV. He played only his last four with Detroit. And the last two of those, he was washed up and a backup catcher while managing the Tigers. In both 34 and 35, Mickey Cochrane managed the Tigers to the World Series, losing to the Cards the first year, but winning the World Series by beating the Cubs the next season. But that doesn't make him a Detroit Tiger more than a Philadelphia Athletic. You got to go with Freehand or Lance, Mickey.
For sure.
Well, let me run something else by you, too. Cabrera was there's one thing George Kell did every time he went to the bat. Every time. Number one, Cabrera could have never carried George's jockstrap at third base. That would have been impossible. But the other thing that George did versus what Cabrera did, George, and I don't know how significant this is when you watch a ball game, but you know George ran the first base every time. He didn't walk the first base. You realize that? And that big old dummy, because he makes $200 billion a year, takes his time running down there, despite the fact that people bobble the ball, kick the ball, and he's still tossed out. If he ever grows up, it'll be a miracle.
Stefan, continue. You guys going on about LeBron being the greatest of all time. It's not even close. It's Michael Jordan, like Denny McClain says. No, I said Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Listen more carefully, Stefan, who then continued. And I think if there's anyone who's comparable to Jordan, my uncle, Dave DeBuscher, said the hardest guy he ever played against was Bill Russell. Now, Stefan, I'm not sure what you were doing in the mid-60s, but growing up in Detroit, I idolized your Uncle Dave, and I went to the Grosse Pointe War Memorial one night to see him give a speech to a small group of us. We asked this. He said the hardest player to guard he ever played against was Lenny Wilkins. He did not mention Russell, as I recall. He said one night they decided to play Lenny totally to his left side because Lenny Wilkins was left-handed, an amazing player. Dave said he had never seen anything like that night in his career. Wilkins went to his right instead. He shot right-handed all night long, and he lit up the Pistons for 38 bleeping points.
Mm. Hey, by the way, so Kelser, Greg Kelser, a good friend of mine in the show, disagreed with my stance and maybe some others that LeBron was better than Michael Jordan. He says, I totally disagree. MJ was much better. He had zero weaknesses. LeBron also had good teammates. Don't say he did it without teammates. He had Bosch, Wade, Love, Irving, etc. Equal to Pippen, Grant, Rodman, etc. He said, if we elevate LeBron because he was quicker or bigger, then go to Kareem, because Kareem was taller too. So don't hold it against Michael.
Hey, you can't talk about Kareem being the best player ever. That's impossible. These two guys can run up and down the court for the entire ball game, make their shots, do the dribble, do the passing, and do all the other things. As far as I'm concerned, they're the two best. I don't know how you define either one of them, but they were the two best players I've ever seen in my life in the NBA.
You want to talk about a serious competition? The unnamed texter is back with us. He says, I'd pay top dollar to see Bob Page play Denny McClain in an esports video game matchup of MLB The Show.
Oh, I was hoping it was a boxing match.
You'd never catch me, pal. Not to shake the
chair. If you stay in the ring, I'll catch
promise.
You.
Hey, Bob, correct me if I'm wrong. There's a few people that write in that dislike you greatly. Wasn't one of them Dennis Hyde? Because Dennis Hyde is praising you in this last mailbag. I wonder if he's had a change of heart.
Yeah, you know why? I'm glad you mentioned that, kind of.
Because he used to rip you constantly.
Because that guy, that creep, has called me the most vile, vituperative names for a long time on this show. And at first, I read some of the garbage he wrote about me so I could respond. Now, you know what? I love Bob now. I actually like Bob now. You know what, pal? I want nothing to do with you. Don't bother to write. Eli can read your stuff if you want. Don't bother to write me anymore because you ain't making the show.
Do either one of you guys know who he is?
No. What's that?
Does anybody know who he is?
Well, he's a fan. He's a listener.
No, I don't know who he is. I just wonder maybe Eli knew him or something.
No, he's a listener. Yeah. No, that's all.
Eli, I got something interesting involved.
Eli's been known to pay a guy to boo you.
Go ahead.
We got time? So anyway, I think you guys are all familiar with the Sabre Bio Project. They write these great biographies. Denny McClain's is fantastic, by the way, on anybody who was ever anybody in the big league. So they tweeted this week, anyone remember Paul Casanova of Cuba?
Sure, I do. I pitched against him.
Getting there. Hold your horses.
All right, take your time.
A big 6'4 catcher with the Senators, for whom he was an all-star in 67 and the Braves. He also barnstormed with the Indianapolis Clowns in 1961 in the last vestiges of the Negro Leagues. Now, Denny has spoken very highly of Paul Casanova here before while hating his manager, Ted Williams. You want to talk about Casanova again? I got a follow-up to this too, Denny.
I'll tell you a real quick story. Paul Casanova threw the ball back to the pitcher faster than what a pitcher could throw to him. That's how hard he threw the ball back. Always. It was always on a line drive, and you never tried to get behind the ball because if you missed it, it was going to kill you. So I grabbed him this second or third game I pitched in Washington. I called him out to the mound. I said, hey, listen, we got to have an understanding. He says, what? I says, when you throw the ball back to me, it's got to have a little bit of an arc. I said, because if you keep throwing these line drives at me, I'm going to get hurt. I said, because half the time I'm not even watching you and you're throwing these BBs back to me. Oh, I'll do better. The first two pitches he threw that night, one hit me in the left shoulder. And I told him when we had the break at the turn, I said, enough is enough. I said, Ted, this is the only time I ever asked Ted for a favor. I said, get the other catcher. I can't take this guy. He's going to kill me. And he gave me Jimmy, can't think of his little guy. God, I can't think of his name.
It'll take until next Wednesday to think of
that. Oh, I know who it was. Dick Billings. Dick Billings was the guy.
Oh, I know Dick. He comes to the Tiger alumni.
Dick is from Michigan State. Yeah, he's living up here now.
I think we're putting, even though people are bored to death and they need entertainment, I think we're boring them to death if we go on too much longer here. What do you got?
I got a follow-up to this. I checked out your team on the greatbaseballreference.com site, and I was looking at your coaching staff. I never knew this. Here's a hero of mine and Eli's from our childhood baseball cards. What was Nellie Fox like?
Oh, Nelson Fox.
Who did he coach for?
He claims he coached for you guys.
No. Nellie Fox, in my life, I don't remember him coaching for us, but I can tell you that one of the guys that made me sign with the Chicago White Sox was Nellie Fox. The Chicago White Sox, when they signed me on that Sunday in 1962, Nellie Fox and Minnie Minoso were in the Cadillac that drove out to see me and to talk me into signing with the White Sox.
Really?
I mean, when Nellie Fox walked into my house and Minnie Minoso, I mean to tell you.
Minnie didn't speak English. He was a Cuban. Stop it.
He could say Denny McClain.
Now, Nellie Fox to me was one of the great pictures on baseball cards where he had the big chaw of tobacco that made his face look like he had some type of growth in there. And he used one of those bats without a handle on it. He used the thick handle. It was like as thick at where his hands were as it was at the top. Right. I think as I recall.
Yep. And my mother, after they had left, my mother said, "Isn't that Nellie Fox so cute? Boy, I could sit with him for a while."
Picture this, you guys. Nellie Fox actually crying in a locker room after a baseball game. Do you know what baseball game that was and why he would have been crying?
Well, no. Might it have been with the Dodgers?
It was with the Houston Colt 45s when Kenny Johnson pitched a no hitter and lost because Nellie Fox made an error.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's a bad day.
Let's end on that fabulous piece of trivia, can we? Really enjoyed Rick Barry. We'll be back on Monday with Gus Johnson and then next Thursday with the great Dave Bing. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you on, what's today, Monday or Thursday? Today's Thursday. We'll see you on Monday.
And folks, don't forget, the plot thickens for Major League Baseball Monday.
That's right.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.